My name's Samara Weedman, and you're listening to CKUW 95.
Of all Canadian prime ministers, was Justin Trudeau the worst when it comes to the country's foreign policy? What do we make of what the foreign policies of Chrystia Freeland and Mark Carney as Trudeau's replacement will look like? Who were the elite players trying to manipulate Trudeau into the role of turning Canada into a technocracy? Are there two forces in the Liberal Party vying for control? And is either one a superior one from the standpoint of working people? This week on the Global Research News Hour, with Justin Trudeau announcing he will soon resign as Prime Minister and as the Liberal Party leader, we will be taking a close look at his record in power and casting a similar look at what the leaders who succeeds him will be like. In our first half hour, we are joined by author and activist Eve Engler, who looks at Trudeau and some of the leadership candidates in terms of their foreign policy. Then in our second half hour, we will talk to researcher and analyst Matthew Errett at the deep historical level in terms of the characters who helped bring Trudeau to the stage and the battles that have played out within the party itself, leading them to what Trudeau is doing now. On this week's program, the rise and fall of Justin Trudeau and a warning about his successors. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 17th, 2025. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this program was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Ininu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The bounty of this land was acquired by settlers from Europe using unjust and unfair tactics against the indigenous peoples. The settler descendants today should be aware of the cost of the wealth they inherited and should seek reparations and reconciliation for the crimes of colonialism and genocide which resulted in order to restore a respectful and enduring partnership in the years ahead. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. The Guardian newspaper boldly announces, quote, Keir Starmer will launch a sweeping action plan to increase 20-fold the amount of AI computing power under public control by 2030, unquote. Hello, there's that infamous 2030 date looming up again. Everything is supposed to be in place to have achieved full spectrum dominance over freedom-loving members of the human race by that date. The Green Deal / Agenda 2030 robotization plan put in place in order to keep the net zero CO2 agenda on track must be maintained at all costs, of course. Everything is stated as being subservient to this insane attempt to annul carbon dioxide and thereby induce a state of suffocation for the plant, animal, and human kingdom. That comes from the article Davos WEF. Artificial intelligence, or AI, DNA manipulation, control of the human mind, transhumans, by Julian Rose, posted January 15th. Instead of reaffirming its neutrality and attempting to act as a peacemaker amid the current tensions, Switzerland appears to be giving in to ongoing Western pressure, which could have negative consequences for the country in the near future. In a recent statement, the Swiss People's Party, or SVP, a leading conservative political party in Switzerland, urged the country's decision makers to act with caution in light of the government's recent pro-NATO shift. The party warned that the current Swiss government is failing to uphold neutrality, a fundamental principle of Swiss foreign policy, by taking a pro-NATO and pro-Ukraine position in its international relations. The statement harshly criticized Viola Amherd, former president of the Swiss Confederation and current head of the Defense Department. According to the SVP, Amherd has proven herself unable of ensuring Swiss security, as the violation of neutrality has allegedly created substantial problems for national defense. That comes from the article, Switzerland Violates Its Historical Neutrality as It Promptly Approaches NATO, by Lucas Lerose de Almeida, posted January 15th, originally published on InfoBricks. According to various estimates, at least 100,000 Ukrainian soldiers fled so far, which equates to approximately 20 brigades. The actual number could certainly be far higher, while those hiding from the infamous TCC, or Territorial Recruitment Office, are numbered in millions. However, the neo-Nazi junta and its NATO overlords don't really care about any of this and keep pushing for more Ukrainians to be forcibly conscripted and sent to certain death. Former Kiev regime's foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, recently stated that the draft age will be lowered, insisting that, quote, when your time has come, you must accept this challenge with dignity, unquote. Amusingly, he also claimed that he, quote, barely persuaded his 18-year-old son not to go to war, but to continue his studies, unquote. That comes from the article, Kiev regime's forced conscription exacerbates manpower crisis amid mass desertions, by Drago Bosnik, posted January 14th, originally published on InfoBricks. Indeed, Richard Nixon let the cat out of the bag when he explained that the very act of being president places one beyond the rule of law. Quote, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal, unquote. This is how we ended up with an imperial president, empowered to act as a dictator, above the law, and beyond any real accountability, and why, quote, we the people, unquote, keep finding ourselves mired in a political swamp of lies, graft, cronyism, and corruption. George Orwell, who died 75 years ago on January 21st, 1950, must be rolling in his grave. In the 75 years since George Orwell died, his works of dystopian fiction, which warn against rampant abuse of power, mind control, and mass manipulation, coupled with the rise of ubiquitous technology, fascism, and totalitarianism, have become operation manuals for power-hungry political regimes wedded to the corporate state. While Orwell's novel 1984 foreshadowed the rise of an omnipresent modern-day surveillance state, his novel Animal Farm aptly sums up the state of politics today, propped up by a two-party system designed to maintain the illusion that voting matters. That comes from the article, Animal Farm Politics, The Deep State Wins Again, by John W. Whitehead and Nisha Whitehead, posted January 15th, originally published on the Rutherford Institute. Besides those house destroyers are bulldozers that regularly uproot orchards. These efficiently hack and dig up fruit-bearing trees, wiping away the livelihood of Palestinian farmers, also protected by troops or armed Israeli settlers eager to expand their property into these useless fields. Anyone daring to stand in the way of this assault is either maimed or killed. The effect of these machines is multiple. First, the physical destruction of homes and livelihoods, then the humiliation, then forced dislocation. That comes from the article, Israeli Bulldozers and Bombs, Barbara Nimri Aziz, by Barbara Nimri Aziz, posted January 15th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar.
We're examining the rise and fall of Liberal Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Global Research NewsHour is a show broadly concerned with foreign affairs and foreign policy, so we thought we would bring in the man who is a modern expert on Canadian foreign policy to critique the foreign policy choices of the retiring Prime Minister. Yves Engler is considered a critic of Canadian foreign policy at the level of Noam Chomsky, as stated in Briar Patch magazine, one of the most important voices on the Canadian left today. And as stated in Quill and Quire, part of that rare but growing group of social critics unafraid to confront Canada's self-satisfied myths. He is the author of 13 books, most of which deal with Canadian foreign policy. He writes commentaries regularly on his website, EveEngler.com. So we join Eve right now to talk about the House of Mirrors, Justin Trudeau's foreign policy. Welcome to the Global Research NewsHour, Eve.
Thanks for having me.
You'll notice I slipped in the name of your book from 2020, which I don't believe we discussed on the program, actually, but it was written over only 4 years into his mandate. But a lot has happened since 2020. Do you think you captured all the basic statements about in the book about how Trudeau's style of governance, or have actions in the most recent past, perhaps even surprising you, caused you to rethink your analysis?
No, I wouldn't say rethink the analysis. I think there's just a litany more of you could call it crimes or examples of. I mean, obviously he's genocide Justin at this point in terms of enabling Israel's horrors in Gaza over the past 15 months. Also, of course, the NATO proxy war. Got going after I wrote the book. And at the time I wrote, there's a section about Ukraine, Russia. But subsequently I did deeper research into, Canada's role there. Post this book, I mean, there's another coup. I think the big elements to think about when you talk about Trudeau's foreign policy is that, it was basically a continuation of Harper's foreign policy. I didn't have high expectations that there was going to be a fundamental shift or some sort of really important shift with the pro-US, pro-corporate, pro-Israel policy of Stephen Harper. But I would say I was a bit surprised. I've been a bit surprised at how much it's really a continuation. And so that's the kind of the big way to look at Trudeau's foreign policy. And then the highlights are from a really negative are, backing coups in Bolivia, Peru in 2022, Bolivia 2019, obviously the aggressive campaign in Venezuela, this incredible support for Israel that there's many facets to. Obviously, there's the continuation of the charities, continuation of these military ties, setting up of a special envoy to basically combat criticism of Israel. That was Erwin Kotler. They call it a special envoy to combat anti-Semitism, but it's really about protecting Israel. There's the Canadian ambassador having a pizza party for Canadians fighting in the Israeli military. On other issues with the NATO proxy war, he's been really aggressive. They ramped up the military training, expanded it, which was begun under the Harper government. That we're talking about, years before Russia's invasion. And what that really was part of bringing Ukraine into NATO, or making it interoperable with NATO. So if not in practice a NATO member, but a sort of de facto NATO member. And also it was really assisting this sort of low-level proxy war that was taking place already between Russia and NATO. And the Trudeau government expanded the training there, obviously sent Canadian troops to Latvia in 2017. So they've taken a very aggressive position on that file. Things like the promise around ending public support for Canadian mining companies found to be engaged in major abuses abroad through an ombudsperson that had teeth. They made that promise. They actually made some steps towards doing that. And then the mining industry came down hard and lobbied hard, and they completely gutted that. And they ended up with a really not much different than this fake position that the Harper government had set up a few years earlier. Another promise on Iran to restart diplomatic relations. They completely failed to do that after the Israel lobby came down hard against that. And then they've gone so far as now they've listed the IRGC, a big part of the Iranian military, as a terrorist organization. They just a couple of days ago they did this. They now call it I don't have the exact name in front of me, but the annual day to commemorate those harmed in airplane accidents. And what it is this was the 5 years of when Iran shot down a plane, mistakenly, of course, 4 days after the Americans blew up General Soleimani, and crass violation of international law. So they've really gone down this path of targeting Iran and demonizing Iran. So the big picture is that Trudeau is a imperialist, Zionist, pro-corporate prime minister, and Canada has, as I would say, really gotten. Oh, and I also say the military, huge military spending increases. It was about 20 billion in 2014 that Canada spent on the military. Now it's up to about 40 billion. So they doubled it, and they've announced a further doubling by 2032. So, a really big military kind of boost as well. Trudeau's foreign policy is more of the same. And on the case of the Palestine question, that's happening in the face of massive protests, really, and really the somewhat of the ripping apart of the Liberal Party, real divisions on that, where there's many MPs who are very uncomfortable with that, and many Liberal voters that are uncomfortable, and many Liberal campaigners and organizers and stuff like that. So he's very committed to that anti-Palestinian outlook. That's the legacy of almost 10 years of Justin Trudeau as prime minister.
Yeah, well, we've had many prime ministers from both of the governing parties, and they've all, I mean, I think you probably agree that all of them have a lot of these same sorts of tendencies. But I'm just wondering if, in terms of what sets Trudeau apart, is it just that he's more of the same, only, with more to it than that, more with more energy or something like that? Is it,
Well, what I would say would set him apart from Harper is that, you look at, Canada is back. That was that big the speech during his 2015 when he won the election, and this sort of like we are, it's playing off this mythology of Canada being UN peacekeeping, benevolent international force kind of stuff. It is, it's mythology. It's not based in fact. But they did. I would say they did really the minimum of even kind of sort of throwing bones in that direction, really. They did obviously rhetorically the big push that was Chrystia Freeland that brought it in was the whole international rules-based order. They really pushed that. That was their main kind of sort of propaganda for their foreign policy, and the secondary one was international feminist foreign policy. It's really, I mean, the most minimal kind of efforts in any way towards, I don't know, call it more internationalism, or call it, you know, helping the world's poor, or whatever you want to call it exactly. I'd say that that's, you know, is it different than Paul Martin's foreign policy, or maybe Jean Chrétien / Paul Martin's foreign policy? No, I think it's there's a lot of lofty rhetoric. If you look at someone like Lloyd Axworthy, who was, of course, Jean Chrétien's foreign affairs minister for a few years, I think 4 years, you know, he kind of the same dynamic, where he made some big sort of claims about rights, and then he bombed Yugoslavia for 78 days and stuff like that. So or, you know, so in his final day, horrors in Indonesia. So there is a history of this. But again, I would say that someone who didn't have much expectation, I've been taken aback at how cynically immoral Trudeau's been when it comes to foreign policy.
Okay, well, you mentioned freedom in your last answer, and I mean, there's a new crew coming. Someone else is going to lead the party, and I know that by the time this goes to air, Chrystia Freeland will probably have announced that she's running. What kind of a prime minister do you think she'll be? Will she be better than Trudeau? I mean, she's been foreign affairs minister for a while. Maybe she's been restrained by Trudeau's approach or something. I mean, what do you think? Is this a chance for Freeland to redirect Canadian foreign policy in a good way?
I would be surprised. I would say Freeland, of the people I know that look like they might run, she's the least likely for that to happen. Because I think that Freeland, if you look at Stéphane Dion, who was Trudeau's first foreign minister for about a year, a little bit over a year, there was some actual efforts. I don't want to exaggerate this, but there were some efforts to lessen tension with Russia. There was an effort, a genuine effort, to fulfill the promise with regards to restarting diplomatic relations with Iran. So I would say Stéphane Dion represented the better side of the liberal establishment foreign policy. And then Freeland was, you know, replaced him, and immediately the Americans, the embassy in Ottawa sent a cable to State Department that the, and this is after Trump was elected first time, said that Canada had adopted, in their words, an America first foreign policy with Chrystia Freeland's appointment. So it was understood that she was, sort of a very pro-US, pro-American empire, or certainly more so than Stéphane Dion was. And I think Chrystia Freeland is much more of an ideologue in terms of, maybe call her a neocon. So I don't think, and then the obvious, you know, file that she really took charge of was Venezuela, and the Venezuelan foreign minister Arriaza, he pointed that out a few years ago, that it was when Freeland took over the file that Canada really took on the Lima Group and really took on the try to overthrow the Venezuelan government campaign. And she was right in the middle of that, the Lima Group and that whole campaign. And obviously we know Chrystia Freeland's position on Russia and the Ukrainian nationalism and all that file. So she's obviously very ideological on that, very close to hardline Ukrainian nationalists, and has been pushing the whole G7 seizing of Russian assets and all that stuff. So she's a Zionist. I don't know how deeply held her Zionism is, but she's clearly a Zionist. She made that when she was went to Israel in 2018. She said, if Canada won a seat on the Security Council, at that point we were going for a seat on the United Nations Security Council, she said it would act as an asset for Israel. Why Canada would act as an asset for any country on the Security Council, I don't know, but that was part of, I guess, sort of stating her Israel bona fides, or maybe if there was concern in Israel that Canada was going to become more pro-Palestinian as part of a bid to win a seat on the Security Council, who knows exactly what she was trying to play to. So I don't think that is now Mark Carney. This guy, he doesn't have a big foreign policy file because he hasn't really been in government. We should note that he works for Brookfield's asset management, which that's, of course, the Canadian octopus. That's the brass can. 100 years ago, it was called the Canadian octopus in Brazil because it controls so much of the Brazilian economy. And I've detailed their role in the coup against Goulart in 64. And they had fascists that were in charge of their business operations. Actually, a bunch of Canadian liberal ministers during Pearson's time were worked for Brascan. So this is a real important Canadian investment firm. I don't know what the exact $500 billion I think they have or something like that in assets, that has this whole history. I bumped into Mark Carney in September at this event where Emmanuel Macron and Trudeau were meeting in the Old Port, and actually Legault, the Quebec Premier, was there as well. And I just bumped into him.
Did you just interrupt one of his speeches or something like that?
No, I just bumped him in the street because I was waiting for Macron to leave, and I was looking for Legault. And he was, I guess, at this event that Macron was going to go to, the French president. And I asked him, Carney, about the Holocaust in Gaza, and he just sort of dismissed it. He just kind of waved it away. No, I'm not going to talk. It was a complicated question. I'm not going to talk. And he took this pretty hard, total refusal to respond. I just noticed that this far right Zionist mayor of Hampstead here in Montreal, who's this serious Israel activist, he's complaining that Carney hasn't said anything in defense of Israel over the past 15 months. I would guess that's probably a smart move for Carney when it comes to the liberal leadership, because there will be lots of people who are sympathetic to Palestinians who will be voting, who have been traditional liberal voters. So I think Chrystia Freeland, certainly on the Palestine question, she will have, that will be a knock against her in her campaigning among Liberal Party members. So somebody who hasn't said anything is probably in a better position on that issue. Maybe might be different on some other foreign policy issues, but on that issue, which I think would be probably the most obviously aside from relations with the U.S., will be probably the most front foreign policy sort of issue. I think that I wouldn't expect that Mark Carney's going to, radically change Trudeau foreign policy, but Chrystia Freeland will definitely not be, it will be more of the same and maybe even worse.
So we're almost out of time. Would you like to talk? I mean, are you researching currently your next book, Eve, and on what subject?
I'm not researching another book. I have a history of Canada's role in Haiti that I've that I've been sitting on for a few years that I need to finish off. But no, I'm just mostly, following stuff closely and trying to kind of branch out into, well, obviously writing lots of articles, but also branch out into do more interviews and post interviews on the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute website or a YouTube channel and on my YouTube channel. Trying to take advantage of more of the sort of media options that exist. I get the impression that book reading is declining as an activity.
Yeah, well, good luck with your ongoing work, Eve. Even if you're moving away from print, and meanwhile, we're gonna strap ourselves in for a real high stakes election in 25. So, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Eve Engler is an author, an activist, and an uncompromising critic of Canadian foreign policy. Visit his site at eveengler.com. That's YVESENGLER.com.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. Probing deeper into the legacy of Justin Trudeau is a man who has written about Trudeau's handlers and a project of destroying the nation state of Canada, or Canada as a nation state. In the end, he says, Trudeau wasn't really a leader, but a puppet of higher forces guiding all of us in a direction not of communism or fascism, but technocracy. We decided to give the man a call. He's, of course, Matthew Arrett. Matthew Arrett is the editor-in-chief of the Canadian Patriot Review and senior fellow at the American University in Moscow. He's the author of the Untold History of Canada book series and Clash of the Two Americas. In 2019, he co-founded the Montreal-based Rising Tide Foundation, and he comments from a deep historical perspective on a number of topics related to Canada-U.S. relations, among other subjects. Matthew, it's good to have you back on the Global Research News Hour. Welcome.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Michael.
So as I understand the narrative, despite disappointing results from recent by-elections in which the Liberals were defeated in all the ridings and low polling results as a permanent fixture for more than a year, Chrystia Freeland popped up and she accelerated the collapse of Trudeau after being informed in a Zoom call, apparently, that she would be replaced by Mark Carney is the banker guy turned eco-warrior. We discussed last time we spoke as finance minister, and then she would wrote this really explosive letter, criticizing him for, political antics and such. And after that, he appeared mute over the entire Christmas break. And then finally on January 6th, he emerged to say he was stepping down. Would you care to comment on Trudeau's resignation and on Chrystia ultimately being the key person to trigger his dismissal?
Yeah, I mean, I've come in the course of my research, as you know, to look upon Canada and the policies that tend to take up various players in Ottawa. I see it in a relatively controlled way and as a bit of a theater. Unfortunately, some might call that cynical, but I think that's just part of life under a Privy Council managed deep state system that's been around for over a century. And when I see, I've always seen Justin as somebody who has played a role, and that role for those who have been his handlers has been to advance a certain agenda that would move Canada ever more towards the type of outcome that we know the Davos crowd of the World Economic Forum and the broader Bilderberger group has in mind for the entire world, which is the transformation of once, industrial sovereign nation states into satrapies for a supranational enforcement tool, a world government of sorts, with a certain type of ideology shaping that post-nation state era. And so Justin's role, he was a bit of a princeling. His father is a bit of a mythical figure, in the Canadian psyche. Pierre Elliott Trudeau has been sold to Canadians as a Abraham Lincoln style character who saved Canada through times of crisis and stood up against big bad American imperialists when it mattered to protect Canada's interests, and there's this whole mythology that's been repeated and baked into a big part of the zeitgeist of especially baby boomer Canadians that made Justin a valuable asset. But when you listen to Justin speak, from his earliest days entering politics in 2000, I guess it was 12, that he was brought in as an MP before being, and he was always set up to become prime minister. He could never really compose thoughts outside of a teleprompter and outside of the comfort of his handlers. And whenever he was put in those few occasions outside of controlled situation, it was a disaster. So
That
he's not.
reminds me, just sorry to interrupt, but I mean, like every time he's been faced with something like that, he just goes silent. Like it happened during the Freedom Convoy when they came to Ottawa. He said, "Oh, I have COVID or something. I can't talk to anybody." And then it's happened again after the collapse of move of Chrystia Freeland. But yeah, you were saying.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's exactly. He just runs away, finds an excuse to not be present if there's going to be somebody who will actually challenge him in a way, which it's understood that that will be a humiliating thing. So he's served a role as, like I said, a marketing tool, and nothing really more than that. So the idea was to always simply use him till he had nothing left to squeeze out of him, and I think that point has come and gone. And his usefulness is now pretty much, it's over. The scandal's built up. He's embarrassed himself in India, destroyed relations with India. The blackface thing, he tried to ignore it. It still kept coming back. His settlement with the family of the underage girl who he had sexual relations with as a high school teacher kept on coming back to haunt him. And just his general detachment from the concerns of your average Canadian worker, it's just too much. And so they're flushing him now. And so I think Chrystia, being a Rhodes Scholar of a, somebody who is part of a slightly upper level management class within the technocracy shaping Canada, was told that now is the time to make a maneuver that would be a signal to shift gears as far as initiating a new vote for a replacement to Justin, which is now what's happening.
Well, let's talk to people about the rise of Trudeau. You wrote that the plans to appoint him, or however you describe it, started in 2006. Who exactly were the key players orchestrating the decision to sculpt him into a new prime minister, and why?
Well, for that, one needs to go back down to the organization, a think tank that was created called Canada 2020. It still exists. They bring in people like Barack Obama and other liberal behaviorists into Canada to lecture. And this was created in 2006, or actually, I think it was a first created in 2003, but it only started really hosting conferences and becoming a more politically present force in Canadian politics in 2006. And some of the co-founders of it included people like John Manley, Bob Rae, Anne McClellan, Bill Graham, and Tom Axworthy were also co-founding members of this thing. In fact, also, I would say Diane Carney, Mark Carney's wife, even before Mark Carney became governor of the Bank of Canada, she was one of the leading, I think, the president of research at the Canada 2020 think tank.
Interesting.
So there's a sort of these are all indications that the Carneys both have been vetted by very high up forces to play a role in determining certain outcomes within the Canadian, system. And it was at their first conference, their big conference in Mont-Blanc in 2006, that Justin Trudeau was first circulated, measured up to if he could be made to have what it takes to be a puppet cutout. And he was a bit of a disaster. He walked in, they say, with sandals, kind of like walking in the shadow of his father, trying to always be the extroverted, cool oddball was sort of his attempt to always do what his dad was able to do with much more class, is what Justin always tried to sort of do in a more lame, awkward way.
Well,
But it,
he was an acting teacher or something like that, whereas his father, I mean, to give him credit, I mean, he was a constitutional lawyer, right? So it's.
Yeah, and his father actually had Jesuit training, could use logic, reason, debate. He had great debate skills. So his father was a much more competent technocratic figure, very rigorously minded, a vicious, vicious character. I'm no fan, but I can respect the quality of mental power that Pierre was able to wield. And he was the type of guy who could go into uncomfortable situations and meet with hostile presidents or hostile journalists on camera and hold his own pretty well. So Justin is just a shadow of a shadow, crippled emotional character whose whole life has been largely, stage managed with flatterers and handlers, including Gerald Butts or, you know, Dominic LeBlanc, childhood friends who were part of always the Canadian deep state, both of them. Mm. Thomas Pitfield, Michael Pitfield's son, is also a childhood friend and lifelong manager handler of Justin. So you got like, these guys who are brought in to be his friends. Kind of Truman. It's kind of Truman showy. When I look at this stuff, that's what it reminds me of. You know, this poor kid. But so there's nothing. There's no real substance. He didn't have like a normal upbringing or childhood set of experiences, and so that shallowness was very clear at the earliest stage. And I took him took the Canada 2020 team some years to, I think, prep him, workshop him to the point that he could be brought out as he was in 2012 to be very soon, first the head of the Liberal Party after Ignatieff took his turn, or maybe then it was Bob Rae who was the interim leader. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Bob Rae is another figure who's a Rhodes Scholar, very close to Chrystia Freeland Rhodes Scholar, and gave up his own seat so that Chrystia would become a member of parliament and be one of the primary handlers of Justin in 2013. So you got this whole thing. And I would also say too, one thing that's important with the Canada 2020 is that they were also, if you look at the background of Thomas Axworthy and Bill Graham was the president of the Canada International Council for a few years, which is the Canadian branch of the Roundtable movement set up by Cecil Rhodes and Milner. So in America, it's the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations. In Britain, the mother think tank is Chatham House, or what's known as the Royal Institute for International Affairs. And their Canadian branch was renamed Canada International Council. So you had Bill Graham, who was in charge of that. Thomas Axworthy was the personal secretary to Pierre Elliott Trudeau for many years.
He was the brother of Lloyd Axworthy, right?
Correct. Yeah. And both men together were also leaders of the task force for the North American Union in 2006 too. Mm. Which was also, I think it has since been rebranded, as I think you've noticed, in the recent months, in the form of the idea of creating sort of a North American technate with US Canada integration that might also include perhaps Greenland, Mexico, and some countries all the way down to Brazil, really, or the upper part of Brazil. So that's currently being floated. It was already being designed, and they had like mock-up currency built on a model of the euro, of what that would look like for the Amaro. And people could see those things online as they were marketing this thing, testing it to see if people would buy it. At the time in 2006, it was, I guess, they received enough negative feedback from their impact studies that they chose to shelve it for a bit. But I think it's a scenario that's being brought back. And this is where I see sort of, yeah, Justin is just, they need somebody now in the position of the prime ministership, of someone who actually has competence and can sort of hold the chip together as the system globally goes into a new phase of crisis. You can't just have any shallow puppet. You got to have a slightly more, you know, competent technocrat type like a Mark Carney if you're going to be able to manage that ship of state.
You just joined us. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michael Welch, and I'm here with the editor of the and chief of the Canadian Patriot Review. That's Matthew Arrett. And we're talking about the rise and fall of Trudeau and what's to come. But first, I just like to maybe get you to maybe briefly talk about with regard to this change of the attempts to convert this confederation into a technate. I mean, it started way, way, way back in the 1930s, but over time they had these moments, and I think as recently as there have been I guess rival factions within the Liberal Party vying for control, perhaps. I mean, there's segments of it that's resisting these sorts of movements, and So, I mean, does that mean that they are that one is good for the people and one is bad for the people, or are they just kind of rival factions, both trying to cement power control for the elites? I mean, what do you think of that?
Good question. The way I tend to see it is that one, there definitely are fissures of ideology, like, but there's a certain set of agreements as well on like general needs to get over nation states, move the full powers of decision making to a completely unelected intelligentsia that has full control of the powers of production, consumption, banking, and other things that will be the completely detached from any type of accountability by institutions that could be represented by the people, whether labor unions or parliamentary or constitutional forms of institutions within society. They want to be liberated from all of that and have a sort of power of gods. So I think you generally have an idea that that sort of configuration is what's desirous, but how to get it is where I think you see some fissures and disputes amongst the Western sociopathic elites. And some of those ideas, some conceptions, I would say, give you more space if you're a patriotic activist with a commitment to natural law and fighting this thing. There's more space to work with within some of those groups. Now, let me give you a quick example. Just to illustrate my meaning in a visceral way, you could see that that dynamic expressed in the form of the battles within the British aristocracy of the 1930s over whether or not to continue to support the Hitler New World Order agenda. And for decades before 1936, when King George the or Edward the Eighth was ousted by a controlled sort of scandal to eliminate him and replace him with a slightly more competent figure as king. He was the Nazi king, you know, and he wasn't alone. Big chunk of the British aristocracy, Lloyd George, was hyper pro-Nazi, members of parliament, very pro-Nazi. Oswald Mosley was just one of many. Chamberlain was also relatively favorable to a Nazi-led Europe and Russia, and the idea was, you know, they were going to have a dividing up of the control of the world with Wall Street aristocrats having jurisdictional control over a big chunk of North America. Britain would have most of its colonies still maintained. Hitler would control, you know, Russia and most of Europe and some of. So there was a big chunk of the Wall Street London axis that wanted to continue with that, and then another faction that realized that Hitler was not the thing that they thought he was. He wasn't as obedient to the prompts he was expected to follow, and had visions of being the senior partner in the New World Order instead of the junior partner. And so there was a big fight. We could see it between groupings of very not nobody was good, but there was a fight, and they decided to ultimately abort their Hitler program for and fight another day, right? So if you didn't have a Franklin Roosevelt, if you didn't have a Stalin, if you didn't have a Mao at that time that had carried out a type of struggle, a battle against the systems of empire, then the world would have looked much bleaker. And the fact that you had this configuration, I believe, of nat like authentic nationalists for all of their problems, but they were not on the side of this depopulation and technocratic agenda, they were able to force a much different paradigm, which took many decades to undermine during the Cold War. So what I see with the case of Canada, you know, we have in the Liberal Party a sort of tradition expressed by the old guard of like Jean Chrétien, who was typically in resistance to this type of program of the technate idea you alluded to. John Turner, another guy who, you know, was prime minister for 2 seconds, generally was resistant to NAFTA and that orientation of world government. Seems at least it seems so. Definitely Jean Chrétien was certainly resistant to it. And you know, I think that they were, for all of their corruption, representing still a bit of a nationalist reflex that was seen by those who had a bit of a memory of C.D. Howe, Mackenzie King, William Lyon Mackenzie King, you know, Odie Skelton, and the old guard of Laurier liberals of the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s, who did represent like authentic nation building. They wanted to really build up a true sovereign nation that could stand on its own two feet. They wanted that. They were not ideologically Malthusian. And they wanted to use the power of the nation state, the instruments of the National Bank as much as they could to build our infrastructure and to do something for the next generation. So you have that. But then you have this other thing. And that other thing is you know, reflected by these. I mean, Canada 2020 is just, they were set up to reorganize the Liberal Party to de-Kretzian it. It was the de-Kretzianification of the Liberal Party during that time when the Liberals were taken down in 2005 through a scandal. And then there was a purge of party leadership and a restoration of more technocratically minded assets under Ignatieff and then Bob Rae that came out dominant. And that sort of same thing was done earlier on in 1960 with the thinkers conferences that Thomas Axworthy also participated in with a network of liberal technocrats in 1960 to 61, right? While after C.D. Howe died and Diefenbaker was in power for 5 years, that 5 years was a purge period where all the C.D. Howe liberals were taken down. Walter Lockhart Gordon played a big role, who later became the architect of a lot of Canada's protective nationalist policies that Canadians tend to have liked. But in fact, I would say at the time, the motive was to simply keep Canada more locked in to the system of the Privy Council of British Empire controls, which didn't like having or seeing their American junior partners. In this case, it was the Rockefellers, you wield their economic clout and power to gain more influence territorially over assets within Canada, which is what they were vying for in the 50s and especially the 60s. Mm-hmm. So Walter Lockhart Gordon was part of the British Empire faction that wanted to keep Canada locked into the crown and the global controls there. And that's why they had to purge the C.D. Howe liberals. So you have these types of conferences that Canada 2020 represented at moments when they need to just sort of do hard shifts, right? Hard shifts on the machine, which are not going to happen gradually. You know, they need to do it more abruptly. So that's sort of the way the Canadian system is managed, I guess, stage managed by the London controllers of the Privy Council. And there's always been a battle, like I said, with their American pseudo allies, sometimes rivals. And I think that this convergence of the Peter Thiel, Silicon Valley imperial Straussians that are currently in play right now and have gained a lot of influence around Trump. Trump, I don't believe is fully one of them, but I don't think he fully understands the game either. I think he's in danger of being an instrument for a different kind of empire. And I think that there is a bit of a battle right now over, just like there was in those two cases I just outlined in my rant. There does seem to be a battle line because you have Russia, you have China, you have countries of the BRICS that have rejected the depopulation agenda, that are increasing their abundance, their productive powers, their excellence, and they're becoming more difficult to battle if we continue on our path of mediocrity. That's been a 60-year program of deindustrialization, mediocritization. So how do we fight them, thinks a geopolitician who's like a cold-hearted geopolitician, if you've made everybody who you need to use stupid and unproductive. And so I think that there's currently sort of a clash of the old guard, hard Nazi movement of the British Empire, which wants to double down on their depopulation, Green New Deal, you know, green genocide agenda, which Mark Carney seems to be a vicious representative of that ideological grouping.
Sounds more like Greenland.
Both. Well, they're both Oxford creatures. They're both in Oxford, I think, around the same time before being brought into broader intelligence operations. Freeland through Reuters, Carney through Goldman Sachs. That's sort of the feeder school, right? Into the
Kabuki. So,
yeah, exactly. But they work together very closely.
But now they're fighting each other. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. I think it's a surface fight for the drama, for the public consumption. But I think that Carney and Freeland both represent the eco-genocide technocrat agenda that doesn't want to change what they've been doing as far as commitment for depopulation under this Green New Deal thing for the past decades. And then you've got this other faction presenting such like names as Elon Musk or Peter Thiel that were, you know, that are trying to really influence Trump heavily right now to build up the physical productive base of the United States, which benefit Canada, frankly. It's possible. As far as just not wanting to do it because it's good or moral, but simply practically in order to fight Russia and China.
Could I just ask you, we're running out of time. Could I maybe just ask you one more question? According to polls, conservatives are leading the liberals now by 20 percentage points, and they've been in the lead for about a year or more. I find it hard to believe that any credible candidate would want to seek the leadership of the Liberal Party in its present state. Why would this grand banker guy want to waste time leading an opposition party, as looks to be the case right now?
Well, I think he's been given guarantees by forces that are much more powerful than him, that this is what you're going to be doing now. And the elections, I believe, are only officially going to happen probably in October, but it could maybe be triggered earlier. Certainly, he's, you know, there's already propaganda. He's being brought into John Stewart. They're really doing a lot of work to brand him again as the great Lincoln hero, the Pierre Elliott Trudeau 2.0, who saved Canada in a time of crisis, the great, you know, so they're already creating a mythos around him and marketing him to an American and Canadian audience. So he's going to be the replacement to Justin. I guarantee it. I've been saying this for three years. You know, I don't know what I agree with you. It's difficult to imagine what kind of propaganda would be needed to shift such statistics, as you just mentioned. 20%, a 20% lead in favor for the conservatives is a very tough nut to crack. I don't know. I don't know how they're going to do it, but I know that people are very malleable and kind of like Julius Caesar, you know, Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. They could cheer for Pompey 1 second and then cheer for Julius Caesar if he offers them more circus, but, you know, bread and circus and drink. So I don't know. I don't have too much faith in the malleability of the mob and how they're played like an instrument.
Well, we're out of time, Matthew, but I really appreciate your look at Canadian history from a deep historical perspective. I mean, could you briefly just remind our listeners as to where they could go to learn more about your writing?
Try CanadianPatriot.org or MatthewErritt.substack.com, but CanadianPatriot.org, you can get all my books and a lot of writings for free as well in there.
Oh, yeah. You recently published a few, right? Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Matthew.
Thank you.
We were joined by Matthew Errett, a researcher, a commentator, and the editor of the Canadian Patriot Review. He spoke to us from Montreal.
That concludes our episode examining the rise and fall of Trudeau. Just a couple of notes before we end this show. CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, the program that hosts Global Research News Hour, is having its annual Fun Drive edition starting February 7th. As a community radio station, we don't receive corporate or state funding. We stay alive thanks to a portion of tuition coming from the students at the University of Winnipeg. Our other source is listeners like you. Please take some time to think about how much the station and this program means to you and send a donation to the station at fundrive.ckuw.ca or send an e-transfer to fundrive@ckuw.ca. And on next week's show, we will attempt to ascertain the direction that Donald Trump will be taking in his second term in office. See you in 7 days.
You're You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation in the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.
Shantir Bhavatu Sarvesham.